My guest arrived a little while ago. She even got an earlier train to be with me this morning. Emily Chalon was born in Hackney in 1984 after 10 years of her childhood spent in the spiritual heartland of Glastonbury. She'll have to tell me more about that. Emily and her family relocated to Cambridge. Here she completed her studies at Hills Road Sixth Form College and then went to Liverpool University to complete her Bachelor of Arts in Music and Media. She was a nationally published poet as a child. At 17, she was internationally published. Songwriting led her to forming a band. You may have seen them at the Cambridge Junction. She'll reference those in a little while. The band has scattered now. But the limitations of poetical verse then caused her to begin to write The Religion of Self-Enlightenment. That was her first book. I'm clutching her second book, which was published at the end of May. May the 31st, to be precise. It's called The Irrivers. I'm introducing Emily Chalon to you now. Emily, very good morning.
Good morning, Phil.
Thanks for coming in and joining us.
Thank you. Busy girl.
I know you do lots of travelling. You do a little bit of book signing as time goes by. But we'll take you through your childhood. As I say, you were in Hackney. What took you out from Hackney as a family, because you're one of three siblings, to Glastonbury?
Wow, Phil. I was very young when I came to Glastonbury, and what happened was my dad had been on a 10-day meditation retreat to the lovely Somerset town, and ended up the Tor on a misty morning and felt the mists of Avalon surrounding him. And apparently it was a profoundly spiritual experience for him. And when it came up, they were in London living at their parents' place, my grandparents' place. And they were trying to decide where to live. And my dad had this recollection of this experience up Glastonbury Tor. And he said to my mum, why don't we move to Glastonbury?
So how old was your dad then when he felt the mists of Avalon?
He would have been
delightful, beautiful.
Yeah, he would have been about 30, edging 30. He had me at 26, and I moved there when I was 2, so 28, if my math serves me well.
So you can't really remember Hackney at all, of course, being a
2-year-old. No, I'd love to pretend that I do when I go to London. I'm like, born under the bells, you know.
Bow Bells.
Bow Bells, exactly, you know.
So you're actually a Cockney girl, really.
Had a push.
10 years then in Glastonbury. Do you know, I've never actually walked down Glastonbury the streets. I mean, I wouldn't, unless you're going to the Glastonbury Festival, you just don't go anywhere near the place because it's just jammed up. But you will remember it, therefore, when all the festivals were going on. Mm-hmm. Did you ever go to any when you were a young girl?
Yeah, I've been to Glastonbury Festival about 10 times now. My first time when I was 2 years old, and my mum lifted me on her shoulders and we listened to Suzanne Vega.
All right.
Yeah, if anyone remembers her, one of my favourites. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful for you. So living in the area as well. Growing up in rural Somerset, really. I suppose because the town is not that big.
Yeah, the town is not big. We have so many stories of when we were little and my dad blagged us into Glastonbury Festival, like pretending that he knew people who knew people and this kind of thing. And we found ourselves in field making dream catchers and hanging out with all the hardcore hippies who also didn't have tickets. And it was before the fence and all this kind of thing. So I was there back in the day.
Because local people probably knew their way to get in.
Absolutely. And it was part of the spirit of it. I mean, no one wanted any trouble or anything like that. I just wanted a good time. So, you know, it was part of the whole ethos of the place that travellers and local people were all welcome there. So, you know, apart from their dogs, we actually dog sat 1 year and didn't go to the festival, and we had about 6 to 10 dogs. And I remember
6 to 10 dogs. Well, you're all your own.
It was no, they were all our friends.
I'd say you're running a kennels business or something. Yeah.
But they all went to the festival, and we ended up piling in a load of dogs into our house. And yeah, it was quite amusing for a little while. You know, I wouldn't do it again, but once in a lifetime, yeah, good.
I have sat on Glastonbury Tor and I've watched the thunderstorm roll in. So I was a bit anxious because I had to get away because we still got drenched. We saw it coming in over the sort of Somerset levels.
Yeah, you would do, yeah.
And towards us, and think, oops, we've probably got about 5 minutes. Oh no, there's a bolt of lightning, 4 minutes. So we had to clear off. But yeah, fabulous to go up there.
Isn't
anybody
it?
ever not been to that part of Somerset? I thoroughly recommend it, Cambridge people. If you're listening, you may be listening in Somerset now, and you say, yep, I know, I'm here right now.
Well, it actually fed quite nicely into my first book, because obviously a lot of people who come to Glastonbury are on some kind of spiritual pilgrimage. They know that it's a place where Joseph of Arimathea claimed to bury the Holy Grail. They know that it's a place of like reverence for a lot of people around the world. And that's what makes it so interesting to live there, because you always meet people who are on a quest, you know, they've woken up at some point in time and they want to find out the holiest sites in the world, and they come from all over the place to come and visit Glastonbury. So I was really, you know, blessed to grow up in such an area and such an environment.
So 10 lovely years there, a decade.
A decade of my life and my childhood years. So I spoke to someone the other day and they were like, you grew up in Glastonbury? I was like, yeah. And they were like, you're so lucky. And I'm like, I am actually. Like, you know, I found it really hard adjusting to Cambridge, because obviously it's such an academic city, Cambridge, and there's a lot of pressure to succeed and this kind of thing, which wasn't the case in Glastonbury. So I had to adjust my personality to suit my new environment quite rapidly. But I did okay, I think.
And 12 years old, because that's kind of a difficult age for the best of us at 12 years old. But yeah. That's when you were wrenched. And then, well, in a nice sense, because you were there with all your brothers and everybody, your sister and your brother, rather, and came to Cambridge at the age of 12.
Yeah, I don't resent or have any bad feeling towards Cambridge. It's just different to Glastonbury, so it took a little period of adjustment, I'd say.
I think you love Cambridge.
I wouldn't say I love Cambridge, but I certainly see the potential in it. My dad moved us to Cambridge for a specific reason, which was that there wasn't enough economic opportunity in Glastonbury, and everyone kind of, to be honest, you know, sat around taking a lot of drugs and this kind of thing, and like, it was inappropriate to raise children in that environment, my dad felt. He wanted to give us a good opportunity in life and that kind of thing, and Cambridge has provided us with that. And my sister, my brother and myself have all gone on to do vastly different things, but we've all found fulfillment in various ways, so that's really a testimony to the beauty of Cambridge.
And you've been drawn in by the Cambridge effect, Emily. That's what's happened.
Drawn in by the Cambridge,
effect. The science, the technology, the culture here.
Yeah, yeah.
And the academia. You attended Hills Road Sixth Form College.
I did.
You weren't there from the very start of the intake then. You would have been in probably what they would have called the old second year at the age of 12. Was it to Hills Road?
No, 12 I went to Coleridge for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Then I went to St Bede's for quite a long period of time, maybe 5 years, which was lovely because it was a mixture, again, there's a theme in my life, a mixture of religions. It was Church of England and Catholics together, which is one of only a dozen schools in England and Ireland, apparently, that practice that ethos. And you two came out of one in Dublin, apparently, and I came out of one in Cambridge, which is quite interesting, I think. I think it fosters an environment of, an atmosphere of tolerance and acceptance of people's religious beliefs, which I've carried through my whole life. You know, I in my books, like particularly my first book, The Religion of Self-Enlightenment, it talks about religion, but it never, ever preaches. It never, ever tells you what to believe or anything like that. So I wanted, as an atheist, to feel comfortable when you read it, as a devout Jew to feel comfortable when you read it. And I don't know if I've succeeded with that, but I've given it a good shot. And not many people try that these days. Most people are standing on their pillar box trying to insist that they're right, which is very different to the way I approach things.
So it's not so much fiction. In any way, it's really your thoughts down on the page.
Well, I made it into a fiction novel because I needed a character to... Basically, I was working at the Granta pub and I met this guy who still to this day doesn't realise that I've written a book about him. But basically, he was so incredibly boring that it took my breath away until he told this story about how he was 17 years old and he used to listen to Pink Floyd on headphones and get a bit merry, let's say. And basically, it was so amazing to watch his eyes, because his eyes just burst like universes when he was telling this story. And I realised at some point in time he'd been a completely different person and actually been very in tune with what he was saying and what he was doing and this kind of thing, and really alive. And I wrote the first line about him, which was, he was the kind of person who's forgotten why he's here. And I thought that was strong enough to hold a book around. So I realised he needed an awakening experience because he was so boring. So I put him in a car accident. Then he has an out-of-body experience, which no one believes, and then he comes back to Earth, goes a bit crazy, and writes a new religion. So that's basically the storyline of my first book.
How does the new religion propagate? How is it met by people? What do they think? Is it received well?
It's so well received. I've had the nicest experiences with people who just say that book means the world to me and this kind of thing. And like, they don't often talk to me to my face, but they talk with one another, and then one of them will confess to me that actually the book really meant something to him or her. And I find it really touching because I wrote this from my heart. I had a nervous breakdown for 6 months and I ended up in bed just thinking about why I'm here and what I've done with my life and what a mess I'd made of it and this kind of thing. And I asked all the important questions, like, why are are we here and what's the right way to live? And I realized it's all about listening to your inner voice. And a lot of people around you try and tell you, oh, you need to live this way, you need to live that way. And the best thing to do is just to ignore them all and just to listen to that voice, which is like a sonar radar guiding you through life. Like some people you get on with, some people you don't get on with, but you know, you have opportunities like bumping into you in the polling station, for example. I mean, just follow your intuition and, you know, it leads you to wonderful things. But a lot of people, especially in the education system and religious institutions and this kind of thing, try and take your keys from you. I always use that metaphor. They try and take the keys off you and say, it's my life and you have to follow. Whereas I insist that the keys are your own.
Yes.
And your perception of life, like your fingerprint and your iris, is completely unique. And we need a religion, in my opinion, which encompasses that. So I've written the Religion of Self-Enlightenment, which is basically all about personal freedom. And the idea is that potentially we might be reincarnating, but no one's really sure because we're in the midst of it. And the foundation of it all has to be love. So essentially, like, that's the religion in a nutshell. But it also talks about the language of belief. For example, the polarity that we're all drawn into between good and bad, holy and sinful, right and wrong, and this kind of thing. And everyone's got a different definition of these terms. But there's no terminology to encapsulate something being okay. For example, if you call Islam okay, you're going to offend a lot of people. It's not okay to call atheism okay because it offends a lot of people. Essentially, we're all in the midst of a crazy maelstrom of experiences and we're trying to make sense of that. And the main character in my book really is quite earnest about trying to make sense of that. And he writes his religion from a good place, from a place of, you know, peaceful understanding and this kind of thing. And hopefully it connects with people. I know I've built up quite a fan base. I've got fans in America, in Mexico, all around the world. And yeah, I'm quite impressed at how people have responded to the book.
The book is called The Religion of Self-Enlightenment, and listening to Emily, if you're intrigued as much as anything by what she's had to say so far. It's Emily B. Shalom is the author. You can go on to sites like Amazon to buy the book. This came out 3 years ago now, wasn't it, Emily, for this particular
It was. It's quite a long time ago now. But my friends say that maybe with the release of my second one that it will have a second wind. So that's what we're hoping for, because it's kind of petered out in terms of, like, I've pushed it as far as I can push it. I've been in the Jewish Telegraph. I've been in various publications around the world and this kind of thing. And I'm wondering what the next stage is in terms of how to promote it. I've probably sold about 700 to 1,000 copies, something like that. And essentially, I'm wondering who I need to talk to, who I need to be in order to promote these books to the hilt, because I think I've written something really special here. And it's just difficult to transmit that from the position of a young woman who most people wouldn't necessarily think of as a serious author, you know. It's quite difficult to make a name for yourself. But I think over the next course of the next 30 years, say, I think people could really connect with it. And I think, along with the terrorist bombings and the terror that we're facing with religion in general, I think I've written something that any right-minded person would like to have as a statement of peace and understanding between us all. So I've put 10 years of my life down on the line trying to make that happen, and I'm quite happy to continue with it. So yeah,
I can see it comes from the heart.
Definitely.
There's a lot of passion as sit talking to me, Emily, which of course the listeners don't necessarily read by listening to you, but I can see the emotion there. And every 3 years, do you reckon there's a book in you? Is that sort of the... Everyone said, as an author says, there's a natural cycle. Do you think yours is about every 3 years?
Well, the first one took me 8 years to write and 10 years to get to a point of prominence. The second one took me 4 years to write. And my third one I've just begun, but I don't know how long that will take. So it's stopping and starting. It's like, yeah.
The second book is very different from the first. The second book is called Rivers. It was published on May the 31st. You've been down to Waterstones here in Cambridge and had a little bit of publicity from it there. But this one is a love story.
It is a love story. Yeah, well, I write extensively about the relationship that my main character has in my first book. Main character of my first book is called Carrick Ares, and he has a relationship with someone called Beth, and I felt like it detracted from the story as a whole because it was too romantic. So I removed two chapters from the first book, and I thought they were strong enough on their own to hold a second book together, and I wrote around those two chapters. So yeah, it's incredibly romantic. There's lots of love poetry in there's a bit of politics as well in there, but mostly it's about the nature of love and trying to understand the craziness that you feel when you do find someone special in your life.
The first book is a lot about peace, and the second book is a lot about love.
Mm.
Yeah, I know you've got a third book on the go. I suggest that there's a lot of understanding in the peace, love and understanding, you see.
I think you're a genius.
No, I don't think so. I'm just a sort of average radio broadcaster, but something like that. I mean, how far have you got with your third book?
Well, it's very exciting, actually. I'm doing a social experiment with my third book, which is writing it in public in a place of it's very visible, basically. I've written every line of the book so far. I'm on line 34 or something like that. And I've written every line on Twitter. And sometimes they get up to 6 likes, which doesn't sound a lot, but it's very encouraging. And I'm basically, I'm writing every line so that people see the process of the progression of a novel from their very eyes, you know. And yeah, it's about my life, but every now and again, lines really strike me, and I think someone needs to make them down. For example, I will not participate in my own destruction was one that came to mind when I was talking about Extinction Rebellion with my friends in Holland the other day, and that's basically the ethos of Extinction Rebellion. I will not participate in my own destruction, and it's given without context and without any kind of like backdrop of the conversation itself, but it's quite a striking line. And I think a lot of people do participate in their own destruction. I think that needs to be discussed. But I'm not one to kind of like lay it out there and spell it out for people. People need to read in their own conclusions to what I'm saying. But if you go through life and you pick out certain lines here and there that you just hear on the airwaves that are quite interesting, it can make for a very interesting novel, I think. So it's called Unnamed, and it's very abstract, and it's not strung together by any coherent storyline. It's just bits and pieces of real life and real experience, which really strike me.
So the two books are out, and I think these are books. I've been given a copy of The Rivers, so I'm going to certainly sit down and read that. And yeah, I think you need a nice little quiet space to really be absorbed by what you've written.
Thank you.
In these novels. I know just one little technical thing. You call yourself Emily B. Shalom in the first book, but your author name in the second book, you've lost the B. Is there a reason for that?
I have a lovely story about my first, but my middle name actually comes from a canal boat holiday that my nanny and granddad went on to a place called Bollington near Liverpool. It's actually a place.
Yes.
And they sent a postcard back to my mum and dad when my mum was pregnant with their first child. And they said, Bollington's a nice enough place, but it seems a bit unloved. So to love Bollington a little bit more, they named their first child after it. So I felt obliged to include that in some way. I know Emily Bollington Shalom is too long a name for people to remember and to put on the cover of a book, but I snuck the B in there on my first book, and then I removed it for my second. So,
well, one of those who loves narrowboat holidays and canals, I have actually heard of Bollington. There you go.
And it looks a bit like Glastonbury, which is really nice.
It's a lovely, lovely, actually a lovely place.
Oh, fantastic. Good
so there
to
we
hear.
Are. You've been named after a lovely place, at least your middle name. Emily, thank you very much. As I say, once again, the books are The Religion of Self-Enlightenment, and the new book out last month, because it was at the end of May, but 1st of June, it was hitting the bookshelves, was The Rivers. And you can find out more if you go online and you use a search engine, Emily Shalom, or go to her website. And she's got a rather fabulous one that you've got a very rich person to do for you.
I'm very blessed.
And it's very impressive as well.
Thank you.
Very glossy. EmilyShalom.com. You can find out more there. Emily, thank you very much for joining us this
thank
morning.
Thank you so much, Phil. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.